Good evening, you are listening to The Truth Tank, and I am your host, The Tank. If this is your first time listening to The Truth Tank, welcome, and if you're coming back for more, welcome back. This is episode 25 of The Truth Tank, and it is the third part of the epic saga of King Herod. This is the sequel to the sequel, King Herod Part 3. It's been a few shows since we've last had a look at King Herod. The last two shows I've done have kind of been a bit more impromptu, less methodically researched. But the good news is I finished research for Part 3 of King Herod. It's a pretty long show. I'm going to break the show up into two smaller parts because it's probably going to be around the 3.5 hour, 4 hour mark. It's pretty fucking long. But I've put a lot of time and effort and research into it. I started writing this one, I think, late December, early January, and it is finally done. We're going to have a look at King Herod and his building projects, his legacy of stone. We're going to be having a pretty in-depth look at King Herod's legacy of stone, the buildings he built around Jerusalem and the surrounding areas, everything from palaces to forts to entire cities. So the next two parts are going to be all about his one defining achievement, the Second Temple. The Second Temple was probably his biggest and most ambitious project. While doing the research, I felt it was very important to try and detail it the best I could and to go into as great a detail as possible. I don't think too many other podcasts have tried to cover it as in-depthly as I have, not to blow my own horn, but the research on this was very extensive. It was really time-consuming and it was fucking exhausting. I only finished it a couple of days ago and I was pretty much drained. So I hope everybody likes it or appreciates it and gets something out of it, because it took a very long time to research and produce. I just feel like I have to cover everything about Herod. He's a very interesting character. He's one of my favorite historical characters. He's a very misunderstood historical figure. And I felt I had to do a very deep dive onto the man and the myth to try and get to the truth of this very mysterious and very complicated figure. The future episodes, we're going to be having a look at building projects such as Masada, Caesarea Maxima, his death, the decline of his empire, and his legacy. On this episode of the podcast, we're going to be having a look at the rise of Hellenism throughout ancient Judah and two of King Herod's most elaborate building projects, one being the palace fortress of Jerusalem and the other the Second Temple. We're not going to get too heavy into the Second Temple on this episode. We're mainly going to be having a look at Hellenism, the palace fortress, and just a brief outline of the Second Temple. The next episode will be entirely dedicated to the Second Temple complex. We'll be having a look at that in depth and in detail, so don't worry, there's going to be plenty more of that to come. I'm breaking them up into two smaller parts, otherwise this podcast will be about 5 hours long and no one will probably see it through. Hellenism does play a big part in the architecture and building projects of King Herod, so I have included a brief rundown of it, which we'll have a look at in the first part of this episode. Secondly, we'll have a look at Jerusalem's fortress palace, and then we'll get into the Second Temple. Before we go into tonight's episode, just have a quick recap of where we last left Herod. He had just killed his wife and a majority of his own family. He had a pretty turbulent and tumultuous relationship with Mariam, his second wife. We also had a look at the various conflicts Herod found himself in on the battlefield with political adversaries and with his own family. So Herod and Mariam's turbulent relationship took center stage. We saw the love-hate relationship between those two and the manipulation of his wife, her mother, and his sister and his own family against him and Mariam's family. Herod is taken out of a majority of his own family at this stage, and his psychological state is rapidly declining. So once again, Herod gets drawn into a conflict that wasn't his own. He had to choose between the Greater Roman Empire and his friends Mark Antony and Cleopatra. So Mark and Cleopatra are dead. Herod has a close relationship with the young Emperor Octavian and his right-hand Agrippa. Herod's kingdom is relatively safe at this time, and he's pretty much untouchable militarily. His enemies are dead. His kingdom has been solidified. He's pretty much got no one standing in his way. He can just rule how he likes. He's got the backing of Rome. Egypt is no more. The Varian and other warring tribes around the area have all been suppressed by with the help of the Romans. And Herod is free to run the kingdom however he likes. However, his biggest threats come from his own family. And as I previously mentioned, he eliminates a lot of these threats. The more his power grows and the less he has to fight for control of Jerusalem, the more he declines mentally. Herod's slip into madness is well underway. So he's very much past the point of no return. The murders of his family and the murder of his wife especially have taken a huge mental toll on him. Psychologically and mentally, he's losing the war. So this also may explain why he was such an avid builder in this part of his life. He's replacing one obsession with another. It's a good distraction from what he's done and how he's got to this point in his career. The kingdom is safe and he can now build it in his image. At this point in the story, Herod has murdered a large amount of his own family. He has his uncle Joseph killed, some of his close friends, and of course his wife Mariam is publicly executed. But that's not enough. He has his two sons, who are the next in line to the throne. He also has them murdered. And finally, he has a troublesome mother-in-law, Alexandra, killed. She seems to be last on Herod's hit list. One thing I never quite understood is why he murdered the two sons. They were a little older, and yes, they were squabbling over the throne, but in my opinion, he could have turned the ship around. He could have used them to his own advantage or given them some power, split them up somehow, made one the governor of somewhere or the mayor of somewhere else. I feel like he could have worked around that issue with those two. I think murdering them was probably a bit over the top and a little heavy-handed. So, what's next for Herod? Alright, so without further ado, let's get into tonight's show. This is episode 25, King Herod Part 3. So well before the Romans invaded Jerusalem, bringing with them their Roman ways and beliefs, the Greek rulers of Judah started the Hellenization of the Jewish world. So this is a fair amount of time before the Romans arrive on the scene. Greek influence wasn't a new concept to the Jewish world. So what is Hellenism? So Alexander the Great spread it all over the world, pretty much. Wherever Alexander went, Hellenism was sure to follow. Alexander the Great's conquests through the Near East, Asia Minor, and beyond brought with it Greek culture and ideas. And essentially, this is what is the foundation of Hellenism. At its core, it's simply just Greek culture and ideas being spread all around the world. Ideas such as Greek theater, Greek philosophy, Greek politics, art, culture, food, you name it. That's putting it very simply, but at its core, that's pretty much what Hellenism is. Wherever Alexander goes, these ideas spread. He spreads them to all corners of the known world. And back then, that wherever Alexander the Great had gone was the known world. I think he covered about 33% of it, so it's a decent amount for any individual, especially in those days. But as we know today, that's not even half the world. He did a pretty good job, but they were obviously going on the knowledge base that they knew about. The Greek world didn't extend much further than India. Everything beyond that was a mystery and an adventure waiting to happen. Hellenism wasn't always a big event. It wasn't always in the form of a grand Greek-style palace or lavish Greek festivals. It also included the spread of Greek ideas and education. And in particular, education was a big factor in Alexander's campaigns with getting recently conquered peoples on side. He didn't go in with force and just kill everybody. He said, hey, look, I'm bringing you these ideas. I'm bringing education. I'm bringing Greek ways that may be a little bit more refined or better than how you guys do things. So why don't you come and join me and we can have the best of both worlds. Alexander learned a lot from a lot of the cultures he absorbed into his empire. He also spread the Greek ideas. This did cause a lot of friction between his followers. Quote unquote, they didn't think they should be shared to lesser people. If you were the conqueror, why should I share my stuff with the conquered? There was a bit of arrogance with the spread of Hellenism. The Greek way was seen as the proper way. Alexander was very tolerant of other cultures, but not all of his followers were. In hindsight, it'd probably be much better to be conquered by Alexander the Great than someone else. In the end, Alexander ends up trusting a lot of these other cultures, especially towards the end of his life. And there was so much infighting and internal politics between the Greeks that he could really only rely on the Persians and the other cultures he had absorbed into his empire. In the Jewish perspective, Hellenism didn't sit very well. During this time, a lot of the Jewish sects were very, very conservative. They didn't like outside ideas, and they especially didn't like the way the Greeks did things. So they didn't like the portrayal of the human body, because in Jewish culture, you don't portray God in a physical form, I'm pretty sure. Don't quote me on it, but I'm pretty sure that's how the story goes. So the Greek gods and religion were introduced to lands that had similar gods and beliefs, and others were monotheistic. So this didn't always go over too well with, you know, the Essenes, the Sadducees, or the Pharisees, and the various other religious groups in Judah. They also didn't particularly like Greek theater, wrestling, or the large amounts of nudity that the Greeks loved. This is a different alien culture that didn't harbor the same values as the Greeks. For the most part, Alexander and those that came after him were pretty tolerant towards other cultures' beliefs. Very rarely does he ever just wipe out an entire population because they don't believe in Zeus. However, religion and xenophobia caused more issues than any other part of Hellenism. Especially in Judah, they weren't very happy about the introduction of these new Greek gods. They had their own god, they didn't need any more. So they have a culture that believes in, you know, 20 to 30, however many Greeks there are in the Greek pantheon of gods. This didn't really sit well with the conservative Jews. They weren't having a bar of it. It also would have been pretty confronting having depictions of gods such as Zeus, Athena, Poseidon. That would have caused a lot of friction. And that might not seem like a huge deal on the surface, but this is a everyday occurrence. The Greeks had Zeus on their coins, as well as other gods. A lot of their public spaces were filled with depictions of giant statues of gods, such as Athena. And that kind of religiously themed architecture wouldn't have gone down very well. A lot of the Jewish buildings were very, for lack of a better word, plain. There was a architectural style of the Jewish world that didn't gel with the Greek. There wasn't any statues of human beings around the place like there is in Greece. There's lots of naked statues everywhere. But this was looked down upon in the Jewish world. There was no depictions of nudity, especially in public places. There was no human statues or even animal. The gods were definitely not depicted, or in the case of Judah, the Jewish god wasn't depicted. This is a big no-no. You could say the same for Greek sporting pursuits such as wrestling, running, the Olympics. This wouldn't have gelled well either, nor would the Greek way of doing things. In the Jewish world, this is kind of understandable that Hellenism was going to be a source of major conflict. Maybe not at the start, but eventually it was going to build and build until it kind of hit that tipping point. It's an issue that slowly builds over time and eventually gains momentum. And it does cause a lot of friction with conservative religious Jewish beliefs. So the lands of Judah were no exception to Hellenism. Hellenism in this part of the world was known as Hellenistic Judaism. It was more or less a blending of Jewish traditions, mainly religious traditions, with Greek cultural elements. It's not a complete religious takeover, but the roots are definitely there. And obviously in a place like ancient Judah, religious traditions are probably not going to be taken over very easily. A lot of the uprisings against future oppressors were centered around religious belief and the right to the religious freedom. The people of ancient Judah would defend their religious rights with the utmost ferocity. They were not about to let some foreign invader tell them how or what they could believe. They would defend that right to the bitter end, and that was the source of a lot of rebellion and a lot of conflict in future years. It wasn't until much later that Jerusalem felt the effects of the Greek world. Hellenism mainly takes off in the surrounding areas of Judah, such as Alexandria in Egypt or Antioch in Syria. And this is a perfect metaphor for Hellenism encroaching onto another culture. It starts to seep in around the edges. A couple of other cultures and surrounding parts adopt it, take elements of it, and they get a foothold, they take root, and they start to influence these cultures. And based on the spread of Hellenism, it's only a matter of time before it makes its way to ancient Judah. It's not too surprising that there was a big Greek population in the suburbs of Egypt. And going back to Alexander, one of his companions, Ptolemy, sets up shop in Egypt. He becomes, I think, the first pharaoh of Egypt, or the first non-Egyptian pharaoh. And that line continues for many, many years. And it's not too surprising that one of Ptolemy's offspring, Cleopatra, crosses paths with Herod generations later. So in a way, Herod's entire life has kind of been surrounded and influenced by the spread of Hellenism. Some of Herod's most loyal companions and friends have all been Roman. We obviously know that Hellenism spread to Rome and had a pretty big foothold. The entire Roman religious pantheon is based on the Greek, as well as the architecture, the way the military is set up, and how they do things. So Herod also has a love for Hellenistic architecture. He's obviously spent a lot of time in Rome and Egypt. Herod has seen the best of what the Greek world has to offer. He likes it. At the same time, some of his greatest adversaries are also victims of Hellenization themselves, such as Cleopatra and the dynastic succession of the Ptolemies. So there's all these little things happening on the micro level that will affect the macro level later on. Hellenism is also the cause of a lot of friction between Herod and the conservative Jewish elites, such as the Pharisees and Sadducees. The priesthood wasn't happy about his love of Hellenism and what he had planned for Judah. So Hellenistic Judaism takes off in the years following Alexander's death and continues right up until the fall of the Roman Empire and its collapse in the West. It also sees the spread of the Islamic influence throughout the Mediterranean. This is an idea that has been around for a very, very long time and has seen a lot of changes in the area and has survived them all. So strangely enough, the fall of an empire and the rise of a new religion aren't really the cause of Hellenism's decline. It's not really known what caused the decline of Hellenism, but it's not too hard to guess what might have contributed to its demise. So unlike a lot of cultures that can get wiped out by warfare, famine, or a natural disaster, Hellenism kind of survives everything and always manages to come out on top. It's not so much a cultural fad that kind of just runs its course and burns out. Hellenism spread right throughout the known world and stayed pretty much untouched. It was adopted by a lot of cultures and a lot of empires. Even those cultures that did try to resist Hellenism to some degree, such as ancient Judah, never really got rid of it. They more or less just had to accept it, move on, or ignore it. It spread much like capitalism. It was kind of everywhere. It was felt in pretty much every part of the known ancient world. If we use capitalism as a modern example of how an idea can spread so quickly and just latch on to other cultures and really just kind of leach into the bedrock of a society or a culture, capitalism is the perfect way to try to illustrate that point. If you look at all over the world, everyone's obsessed with money. Everyone loves the capitalist system, even if the cultures were not originally brought up on the capitalist system or have evolved with a completely different set of values and ideas. I definitely draw the comparison between Hellenism and capitalism. I can kind of see how it would be appealing, but also offensive at the same time. You want to turn away, but at the same time, you have to look. Like we see in the modern world with technology and the rise of new enterprise, a lot of the old world and the old guard simply try to dismiss it as a fad or just will hope that it will go away if they ignore it. If we ignore the issue, it will go away and everything can go back to normal. So I think this is kind of what we see here. A lot of these cultures just think, oh, this is just a stupid new idea. It'll blow over. It'll be forgotten in the next couple of years and everyone will go back to the way things were. But unfortunately, it was a very, very attractive and seductive idea. For all its controversy, Hellenism is unique because it does latch onto every part of culture and society, the same way capitalism does. So going back to the fall of Hellenism, so strangely enough, there is one defining factor that could have contributed to the downfall of Hellenism, and that is Christianity. The rise of Christianity had a lot to do with it. The old gods were dead and gone, and had been replaced by a new theological ideal. So in other words, Hellenism died out. People lost interest. Hellenism lost its appeal over the centuries. Hellenism had a good run, can't really complain. It pretty much had influence for about 2,000-3,000 years. Can't really be too upset with those numbers. It survived a lot of shit over the centuries. It saw a lot of things happen and change, and it survived most of them. The powers behind Hellenism, the Greek and Roman empires, were a thing of the past, so it's not really a huge surprise that these ideas had staled. Without the original cultures that inspired the movement in the first place, it was going to be very, very hard to revive it in the wake of this entirely new way of living and thinking. So Christianity wasn't a wholly new concept, it had been brewing for quite a long time. Hellenism had a good run, and it couldn't last forever. It was eventually going to get replaced by a new ideal. So this new Christianity, its ideals and its philosophy were vastly different from Hellenism. It didn't appreciate or really acknowledge the opulence and grandeur that was Hellenism. That time had come and gone. Christianity was going in a far different direction. Christianity was more or less about stoic resolve than it was about celebrating this pantheon of finely chiseled gods and goddesses. One god replaced the many, and it changed the way people in the area started to think. So the values that Hellenism brought were just not applicable with Christianity. The value and mindsets had changed, which I think really kind of cemented Hellenism's fate. It just wasn't relevant anymore. So this is kind of similar. Well, it's not really similar, but it's the best way I can explain it on a modern scale. Records are the dominant form of media for many years, until they get replaced by the cassette tape, which eventually gets replaced by the CD, the MP3, and now streaming. The same way there was film, then beta, VHS, DVD, and now Blu-ray. Kind of a similar thing, one just gets phased out because of a technologically superior opponent. In the terms of Christianity, it was the spiritual and psychological superior to Hellenism. The values had changed, and they weren't going to go back. So going back a bit, Hellenism had surrounded the lands of Judah, but it was still on the outside. It hadn't quite penetrated the heart of Jerusalem yet. This is where Herod comes into it. After all, he was a client king of Rome. Not really that much of a shocker that he has a special affection for Roman ways. A long time after Alexander's death, Hellenism starts to become a problem for this part of the world. Hellenism was prevalent in Herod's time. He had adopted many Roman ways and had pushed for the Hellenization of Jerusalem. This is also called the Second Temple period, which in a way was another conflict that Herod had inadvertently started. So Herod is now engaged in a cultural, architectural, and theological conflict. So on the other hand, Herod really isn't solely responsible for Hellenism in Jerusalem, but he was definitely an advocate for it. And unlike a lot of kings that came before or after him, he definitely vouches for Hellenism in a very big way. Conflicts arose between traditional Jews and the many sects of Judaism and the pro-Hellenizers. Greek influence had been around for a long time by Herod's day, and it had caused a few issues along the way. So going back to part one, if you remember the Seleucid Empire. So the Seleucid Empire was founded by one of Alexander the Great's companions, Seleucus Nicator, or Seleucus the First Nicator. He had a great deal of influence throughout the region, and he was pretty much responsible for bringing Hellenistic traditions to Judah. One of the last Seleucids to try their hand at Hellenization was Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes, 175 to 164 BC. So he was the ruler of Palestine. He definitely went against the grain and began to force Hellenization and Greek beliefs upon the Jewish people. So this is a case of Hellenism by force. He was definitely an aggressive advocate of Hellenism, and he was going to do anything in his power to make everyone believe it. So if you're a ruler and you want to make a mark, okay, maybe this might be the way to go, but I kind of don't get the forcing of your beliefs into somebody else, because ultimately, it's just going to breed resentment and rejection of that idea. You want people to willingly and freely follow it. You want to present the best sides of it and go, hey, look, this is what I'm offering. Why don't you come and join my team? You kind of want to refrain from, you need to believe in Hellenism or else. So Antiochus' predecessors had allowed the mainly Jewish populations of the area to worship and carry out Jewish customs unhindered. They didn't feel the need to force Hellenism upon the population. So when Antiochus comes to power, at the same time, a power struggle and internal fighting had broken out throughout the high priesthood, who were the power brokers and decision makers of the Jewish world. So up until now, the Jewish freedoms that were granted by previous Greek rulers were beginning to dry up. The high priesthood kept the wheels of the Jewish world turning. So these are the high priests, the Essenes, the Sadducees, the Pharisees. These were the same elite rulers that were making decisions in previous centuries and who would also come into play in Herod's day. These were the same forces that Herod had to go up against to get his ideas approved. You can't do much in Jerusalem without going through the high priesthood. So this is causing a lot of conflict. These Greek ideas that had been shoved down the Jewish population's throats, it had made its way all the way up to the high priesthood, and people were not happy about it. So it's probably not that surprising that Antiochus forces Greek beliefs upon the Jews, and he pretty much starts at the top. So was this just the opportunity he'd been waiting for? Did he see the high priesthood as a bunch of outdated old men, or maybe a threat? Or maybe he just didn't like their ways and he wanted to change them by forcing Hellenism upon them? So to make matters worse, Antiochus is beaten pretty badly by the Romans in 160 BC. So this is a pretty humiliating blow for a guy in his position. He views himself as a strong, competent military leader. He's taken over Jerusalem. He's telling people what they can and can't believe. He's spreading Hellenistic ideas, and he's probably feeling pretty untouchable. So this is still probably pretty early on in the Roman days. They obviously weren't the massive, unbeatable opponent that they would be in later generations, but they were still a threat to reckon with. So Antiochus, he gets his ass kicked by the Romans. He is determined to prove himself and reassert his power. And unfortunately, the Jews were in the firing line. He was going to take his frustrations and anger out on them any way he could. So Antiochus takes his army and heads for Jerusalem with a very big chip on his shoulder. The Jews were easy targets for his rage, and ultimately they would bear the brunt of his anger. So Antiochus wasn't stupid. He knew all too well how things worked in Judah. He knew about the high priests and was well aware of their motivations. The high priests didn't always have the people's best interests at heart, and he wasn't all about religion either. Arguments and fights would frequently arise about politics and factional issues. The high priesthood wasn't all about religion and theological ramblings about which religion was right. A majority of the arguments that broke out among the high priesthood were about politics and factional issues, the same shit that people are still complaining about thousands of years later. How does Antiochus deal with the high priesthood and implement some Greek changes? Well, easy. He targets the high priesthood in an attempt to lessen their power. He does this by pretty much forcing Hellenism on the Jews. It was going to be his way or the highway. So what does Antiochus do? He steps the game up. He goes all out. He bans Jewish customs and practices. Antiochus comes out the gate swinging. He bans religious beliefs, practicing worship in public areas. He bans all the core fundamentals of Jewish religion and belief. He has pretty much said, fuck you, this is how things are going to go. You're not adopting this quick enough. So I'm going to ban it, and we're replacing it with Greek beliefs, worship or die. So Antiochus, he builds shrines to Greek gods. While this isn't the biggest issue on the surface, as there is a significant Greek population in Judah at the time, so you can make the argument that he is facilitating the Greeks who were already there and had been there for thousands of years, as most of the areas around the place had a huge Greek population. It did become an issue when Jewish people were forced to pray to the Greek gods. And this is a very big insult, because first you're banning the worship of Jewish customs and practices, so now you're forcing Jewish people to pray to gods they don't believe in. Looking at this from another angle, both sides are to blame for this. Both sides have a complete lack of tolerance towards one another and a lack of respect for others' beliefs. Antiochus could have been more flexible. He could have let the Jews freely worship whoever they wanted. The high priest could have also shown the same courtesy. But both sides were very stuck in the mud. They were clinging to their ideas and none of them were going to budge. And ultimately, it was the people of Judah that would pay the price. So Antiochus goes that one step further, which is overstepping the bounds by about a mile. He decides to dedicate the temple of Zeus. He also opens up a temple to anyone who wanted to pay their respects to the gods. So this is a pretty blasphemous act. He's opening up these Greek areas of worship, and he's forcing people to worship in them. So Jewish belief has been outlawed. This is a very ballsy move by Antiochus. He is going to upset a lot of people by doing this. So Antiochus continues his crusade against Judaism, enforcing harsh laws upon the land. He's basically stamping out the Jewish way of life, more or less. He's not giving people the freedom of choice or the freedom of beliefs or culture. He just wants to step all over them. So his aggressiveness was motivated by his lust for power. Not a huge surprise there. Most people like him have a similar problem. So Antiochus wouldn't survive politically if he couldn't consolidate the land. And this was done by uniting everyone in the land with a single belief system, and that was Greek. So unfortunately, he underestimates just how strong Jewish beliefs were and how deep the roots of the religion ran. So it wasn't much of a shock when people revolted against the harsh laws in a full armed conflict. The resistance had begun, and Antiochus' days were very much numbered. A local priest from the small village of Modine, named Mattathias, organized the resistance with his five sons, and he took the fight to Antiochus in a very big way. He launches a guerrilla warfare campaign against the Greeks. His tactics were so successful that 3 years later, Antiochus was heading for the hills, retreating. Judah could now go back to how it had been many years before. Mattathias and his sons were from then on known as the Maccabees. Mattathias being the first of what would become the Maccabean dynasty, and obviously this is the same Maccabean dynasty that is the cause of so many problems for Herod later on down the track. That was a very brief, compressed history of Hellenism. As I mentioned about the tedious amount of research undertaken for this episode, my show notes are over 33 pages. There's a lot of information and key things I kind of had to get out. By the final episode of the Saga of Herod, I could probably have written a book. There's a lot of information to cover and a lot of key stuff that I felt necessary to try and convey. So I hope you all appreciate that out there listening. The 33 pages. It was fucking exhausting. I put a lot into it, and the next part is probably going to be just the same. Given that Herod built a lot of stuff, and I've only covered really one facet of that building legacy, and he had some very important, very cool sites that we haven't even got to yet. So I hope you're not getting too bored with King Herod. I just felt, like I mentioned before, I feel compelled to tell the Herod story, and I like to get into lots of detail. So thanks for sticking with me. So now enter Herod. So Herod, too, was a lover of Hellenism and what it could bring to and how it could transform Judah. He saw Hellenism as a future, and his kingdom could benefit from this more sophisticated way of living. So that's one thing a lot of historians neglect to say about Herod. They're so concerned about calling him Herod the Mad, Herod the Builder, and describing his mental state. If he was around today, he'd be called a futurist. He could obviously see the way things were going, and he could see that Judah needed a shot in the arm in order to facilitate what he saw the future as. He was obviously cherry-picking the parts of Hellenism that he thought he could incorporate into Jerusalem. Obviously, he stayed well clear of anything religious. He wasn't going to upset the high priesthood or make that mistake again by trying to force a different religion onto people. I don't think he ever did think that, and that wasn't obviously not his direction. He was more physical. He was more interested in the architectural side of Hellenism and some of the cultural aspects of the Greek world, such as bathhouses, stadiums, theatres, markets, that type of thing. So Herod's Hellenism wasn't the same as Antiochus. Herod was inspired mainly by Roman architecture and culture. So the Romans replaced the Greeks in the region as the new superpower, spreading their Roman version of Hellenism. So there's two types of Hellenism going on. You have the older Greek-style Hellenism, now you have the more updated Roman Hellenism. This also probably explains why it was so prevalent and why it lasted as long as it did. This is obviously a more updated Roman building style. The gods were obviously different, and so was the political system. The Romans did try to force not so much religion. They were more tolerant, I think, than some of the Greeks had been to Jewish religion. I don't think they cared as much about what you believed. Obviously, in later times, they did. And this is a huge cause of conflict between the Romans and the Christians, was the Christians refused to acknowledge the Roman gods. Now, the Romans wouldn't have cared if the Christians had just said, we can worship the Roman gods on a Saturday and we'll do our thing on a Sunday. That's a different story. But it was more the building and the political system. The Romans liked to spread Roman law wherever they went, and Judah was no different. And Roman law is a big facet of the Jesus story, and that plays a very big part in it. So they weren't as aggressive or repressive as Antiochus had been with the spread of Greek Hellenism. To the locals, it would have seemed like same shit, different invader, with the same or similar idea. So the Romans had been in Judah at this point for a pretty long time. However, the damage was done by Antiochus' abuse of power. Antiochus' abuse of power had inadvertently started a culture and tradition of resistance in Palestine. And this resistance was focused primarily at new ideas and rulers looking to implement pretty much any form of change. So this is the legacy of Antiochus. He basically kickstarts the Jewish rebellion that pops up all throughout Jewish history. This is one of the main reasons that Herod came up against so much resistance during his reign, and why he ran into so many roadblocks, especially with the high priests and the powers that be. They were probably terrified that he was going to destroy the Jewish world again and replace it with a whole new set of ideas. Yes, he was from the area, but like we saw in previous episodes, his legitimacy was constantly attacked on the basis of his father's origins and him not being a true Jew. He was an Idumean by birth, Jewish by way of conversion. So the biggest difference between the old and new superpowers on the block was Rome was not Greece. The Jews, especially those of which that lived in Palestine, had figured out that this enemy was much different and was more than likely not going our way without something astronomical taking place. The Romans weren't as easy to deter as the Greeks were. This worked against the Romans. They had to govern an area that had become so fractured and set in its ways that any sort of outsider had an uphill battle just to make the most basic of changes. If you look at this in a political light, this is also probably more than likely why Rome had favored Herod and his father. They could see that these two were very aligned to Rome's philosophy, Rome's way of thinking. So why not back them and hope that you can make good on your investment later down the track? Because as I said in the previous episodes, Rome needed Herod and Herod needed Rome. These two were a match made in heaven, and one could not survive without the other. Herod having a successful and turbulence-free reign was beneficial for Rome's interests. Herod also had the benefit of being half-Jewish, and his father being half-Jewish. As we covered in the first couple of episodes, they were from the area, they were the ruling class, and they were aligned with Rome. So it's a win-win situation for everyone. This takes us up until where we last left Herod. So now enter the star of the show. When we last left Herod, he had just had his wife Mariam executed. He had his troublesome mother-in-law murdered along with his brother-in-law. But worst of all, he has his two sons he had with Mariam and the next in line for throne executed as well. His descent into madness was well and truly underway. The murder of Mariam haunted and followed him for a long time afterward. To keep track of the timeline, it's around 28 BC at this point, maybe a little before, maybe just after. We'll come back to Herod's family matters a little later. Sticking with Hellenism for the time being, Hellenism is another vital part in the Herod story. It also formed the backbone of his kingdom and led to some of the time period's greatest cultural and architectural achievements. Like everything in Herod's life, it wasn't smooth sailing. Herod's ambitious projects did rub more than a few people the wrong way, and it did cause a lot of backlash from the conservative Jewish sects in the city. Like everything, there was pros and cons to Herod's plans. So let's have a better look at Herod and Hellenism. So it's no surprise that Herod loved everything Roman. I don't think I need to go over the history of Herod and Rome any further. It was not much of a shock when he started to transform Judah into a mini Rome. Herod Hellenized the Jewish world through his love of architecture and building. After all, his nickname was Herod the Builder. He revolutionized Judah through various building projects. Although this did cause some friction, it was good in the long run. Like today's political slogans, it created jobs and growth, and it created a lot of jobs in a time where bored people could become revolutionaries very quick. So it was in everyone's best interests to keep everyone busy, keep them happy, keep them fed, and keep them paid. Herod's time was also the most prosperous and peaceful, not all, but in a majority of Jewish history. There wasn't revolutions, people uprising against the system, arguments over politics or religious beliefs. And why was this? People were busy and they had things to do. The Jewish world needed to be built, and it was the Jewish workers that got the call. And when you think of it, like, it wasn't just builders. This would have had knock-on effects. More food would have been needed. That means more cooks, more people making bread, making tools, making clothes, accountants, tax agents, construction, raw materials, transport, security, designers, architects, artists. These massive building projects generated a lot of jobs outside of the construction industries. All facets of life were geared to building the future. And business was good. It was good for everybody. It kept people prosperous, happy. It kept them fed. And it kept money in people's pockets, which means the construction workers are going out buying things. Artisans and people, merchants, can start selling more stuff. Business was good for everybody. There was little to complain about in a time that could be very violent and be turned upside down very quickly. I'll say one thing for Herod, he didn't do small and he didn't do easy. A large amount of his building projects were pretty epic in scale and took decades and multiple decades to complete. He was building for himself and for future generations. I don't think one single project he undertook was small in any way. There was a degree of difficulty to everything the guy did. Whether it was building an aqueduct or a amphitheater, or to planning an entire portside city. Everything was on a grand, opulent scale that required technical prowess, artistry, and a scale of construction that had very rarely been seen. Some of his projects were civil projects that modernized Jerusalem and brought more reliable infrastructure, such as aqueducts, ports, and public facilities. Other projects, like his palaces, were outlandish displays of luxury, and Herod did love Roman luxuries. He was a man of fine taste, and even before he built, he favored the lavish lifestyle, and he wasn't afraid to admit it. He was going to build a palace, and he was going to build the best damn palace that had ever been built in the history of the Jewish world. There were usually two differing reasons or excuses for some of the building projects. One was usually political, as is the case in his greatest achievement, the Second Temple. Herod had hoped it would garner a bit more support from the Jewish sects and the more conservative of Jerusalem's population. The second reason was purely personal. He wanted structures that were worthy of his grandeur and stature. He wanted to leave his name in stone, such as the Palace of Masada or Herodium. Herod's projects were so successful and well built that some of them are still standing to this day. I think most of them are still standing today in varying forms of decay, obviously. They've been standing there for thousands of years. But it's a testament to the design and the construction of Herod. A lot of architecture didn't last as long, and there's elements of Herod that are still visible within it. There's lots of Herodian architecture that is still around today. It's also a testament because these structures have survived thousands of years of war and invasion and destruction by pretty much everybody, and yet they still stand. They've survived thousands of years and will survive thousands more. And that's saying something considering the city of Jerusalem has been besieged more than a few times. There is even a specific name for the buildings of this time period, between 37 to around 4 BC, and that is Herodian architecture. Herodian architecture is a classic style, but there is a modern and timeless look to these buildings. They're also testament to Herod's vision and foresight despite his personal issues and his rather erratic mental state. So you could say that Herod preoccupied himself with architecture after Mariam's death. It served as a nice distraction from, ultimately, the situation here that he had created. He also had a passion and a vision for building, and now was the perfect time to build his Jerusalem. So there are 18 main building projects Herod undertook during his reign. Now, out of that 18, there were 34 buildings and renovations that were completed by Herod, with the majority of the larger buildings having additional structures and additions being either built or renovated upon. And I think that speaks volumes. That's a real testament to Herod's, one, to his building construction, and to two, his vision for Jerusalem. Most emperors, kings, or rulers have a fraction of the amount of building projects under their belt, let alone constructed ones. I mean, the average Roman emperor has probably between 2 to maybe 4 building projects to the name, with a lot less of those projects actually surviving. There's the Arch of Titus, the Colosseum, and a few other big things around Rome that were from different emperors. But most of them are just one unique structure that lasted, or a couple of smaller ones, where a majority of Herod's big ambitious building projects are still around. So starting in chronological order, we will have a look at them all. So, as I said, we will be covering every one of these building projects in detail. They won't be as in much detail as the Second Temple, which we'll come to in this episode and the next one, mainly because the Second Temple was such an important and ambitious project. It is worthy of a couple of podcasts, in my opinion. Projects like the civil construction, I won't be doing a four-part episode on, but I will be giving a decent amount of information on. First up is Herod's palace in Jerusalem. So Herod loved dual-purpose palace fortresses. He was very passionate about form and function, luxury and protection. Herod loved to combine the duality of several elements such as luxury and function, like a fort or your protection and opulence. That's a reoccurring theme throughout his architecture and throughout his work. He combined luxury and function, opulence and defense in a very seamless way. This is another unique trait of Herod. A majority of historical buildings and structures are pretty one-sided. They usually favor function or luxury. Take the Colosseum for instance. Yeah, though you did have the luxury boxes for the elite, but the structure itself isn't a luxury structure. It's very functional. It's basically an arena where people watch other people kill each other. Herod definitely has a theme of duality that runs throughout his buildings. He loved to combine elements and get original. And this probably would have been a very big thing back in Jerusalem, because there probably wasn't a lot of multi-purpose buildings around. Obviously the temple, obviously people met there. There was markets, but there's also temple and religion, politics and law that went on. I doubt previous fortresses would have had luxury in mind. There would have been very simple, very Spartan style of architecture that did its job, protect the inhabitants, keep people out. And after all, the engineers of Jerusalem were experts at fort building. Jerusalem, after all, had been attacked more times than any other city in history, and it still stands today. So it's testament to the engineers and the construction methods. However, that you don't need a lot of luxury, you just need to protect the people inside. You just needed to keep the bad guys out. Herod had a different vision and more ambition. So Herod's palace was located in the northwestern wall of the upper part of the city. It was built during the first century, and it was Herod's main residence, as Herod had more than just a few to choose from. Herod could rule the city of Jerusalem in safety and in comfort. It was more or less a Jerusalem nesting doll, or a small Jerusalem inside a larger city. After all, this is where business was done, and it made the most sense as his base of operations. It was close to the heart of Jerusalem. It was close to where the common people were, and he could rule from a fortified structure presiding over the city. Tactically, it makes good sense. You got a clear view of everything around you. So there's no better place to lead. It does make a lot of sense that from a safety standpoint, from a psychological and a physical standpoint, that this would be the place of choosing for a king. Rule from the fort on the hill. And also, given that a lot of people and visitors came into Jerusalem, and this is probably one of the first places they would see, it also says to a traveler that the king is accessible and he's here in the city. They don't have to go hundreds of miles out of the way to some sparsely populated region of Judah because the king has a safety concern and doesn't want to stay in the city for whatever reason. The palace was made up of two sizable wings, which were located north and south of a garden. The gardens were impressive and contained fountains made of bronze. They also had canals and groves in them. The outer walls were formidable and were designed to withstand any attack. And as I just previously mentioned, Jerusalem got attacked a hell of a lot, so wall defense was going to be a high priority. The whole palace was built on a platform 1,000 feet by 180 feet. So it's a pretty sizable palace, enough room for the kids and to run around and walk the dogs, but I guess Herod killed most of his family, so I guess space wasn't that important to him. But either way, it's more of the psychological statement of, I have a large palace and it's fortified, fuck with me if you dare. As with most palaces, there were all the modern facilities, baths, dining halls, and enough room for several hundred people. Times this by two because the palace had two wings, and each had their own set of dining halls, facilities and baths, and all the modern comforts. All of this sat nicely on retaining walls that elevated the palace. So Herod had a sentimental side. He liked to name buildings and cities after those close to him. The two wings were named after his friends and the men that helped him get to where he was. One wing was named after Caesar and the other Agrippa. So he doesn't just honor his friends, he also dedicates a few structures to deceased family members, even if he was the one that was responsible for their deaths. So he's not a psychotic killer or a madman. He definitely does have an emotional side. And looking at that deeper, is he expressing regret through stone? He's expressing regret through buildings. Is this Herod's way of apologizing? He doesn't have to build anything after the deceased family members that were his own fault. He could just sweep it under the rug and forget about it, but he doesn't. He chooses to name him. So I think he generally is very remorseful about what he has done. And in my opinion, I think he knew that this was a political move to consolidate his own power. So he was willing to win at any cost, and he was going to put consolidating his power above even his family. So just north of the wing, Herod erected three large towers, which he once again dedicated to the fallen. So this is where Herod again blends his love of form and function. The towers were a defensive element that would serve as the last line of defense if things went sideways. And given the track record of invasion, it was a pretty wise investment. Doesn't hurt to have an extra layer of protection when you're in such a volatile part of the world and you lived in the city that everybody wanted a piece of. So each tower was named after a close and deceased member of Herod's family. One of the towers was named after his brother Phazel, who died helping Herod take back the city. One after his dear friend Hippicus. And the final tower was dedicated to his beloved wife Mariam. So, as I mentioned about him being emotional and not wanting to forget the dead, I think he's accepting full responsibility of his actions through stone and his remembrance through stone. To get psychological for a minute, the towers, like the wings, were a physical reminder of those he had lost. As we know, he loved dual-purpose structures, so there is no better representation than these towers. The towers serve the purpose, but also as an emotional connection to the past and to those who helped get him where he is. To go even deeper, and to add another level of mindfuckery, the towers are all different sizes, so maybe Herod is telling us something. The higher the tower, the more loved the individual, the more important they were to the king. So in other words, the higher the tower, the more he liked you. The smaller the tower, the less you ranked in Herod's world. So no surprises who had the tallest tower. Phazel takes that honor, standing at a whopping 145 feet. So next up was Hippicus at 132 feet. And in last place, not surprisingly, was Mariam. Mariam's tower stands at 74 feet. She gets the short end of the stick. Her tower is about half the size of everyone else's. Even though it was the smaller of the three towers, there is still a subliminal element going on here. Her tower was the most lavish and beautiful. No surprises there either. It wasn't just there as a defensive structure or for warfare. Josephus commented on this. This is a quote. "The king, considering it appropriate that the tower named after a woman should surpass in decoration those called after men." So there is a degree of love and respect here, even though the relationship ended pretty badly and her being allegedly strangled to death. Like a lot of the old city, not a hell of a lot is left today. The Hippicus Tower, or what is believed to be the Hippicus Tower, may also be the remnants of the Thasel Tower, as this is the only one out of the three towers that still remain. Only the lower part of the tower still remains. The other two have completely disappeared, but no one really knows what happened to them. There's no records of them being destroyed throughout history or being dismantled or repurposed or anything. They just kind of disappear from the history books. There are, however, the remains of two smaller Hasmonean towers that have been discovered in the courtyard of the old citadel. However, they are not related to Herod's time period and the Hasmonean towers are believed to have been built at a later date, but there's not a hell of a lot known about them or why they were even built there. So that would also lead us to assume that Herod's towers were destroyed prior to the building of the new Hasmonean towers. So today the site is known as the Tower of David. The name was changed by the Byzantines. Due to a case of mistaken identity, they thought it was Mount Zion and decided to change the name. There's not a lot of backstory on that, and it is kind of confusing as why they thought that was Mount Zion. And obviously there was no Google back then, so they couldn't just check the location of anything. So that may have just been an honest mistake, or maybe they were looking for something else. Anyway, moving along. So next up we have the most famous of all Herod's projects, the rebuilding and expanding of the Second Temple Complex, also known as today's Temple Mount or just simply as Herod's Temple. The temple was Herod's most ambitious project, and it would keep him in good standing with the high priesthood, conservative Jews and the varying sects of Judaism, like the Pharisees, the Sadducees and the Essenes, that used the temple and respected it. So like I mentioned about this being a politically motivated building project, Herod is pretty much keeping all parties happy, and if they're happy with the reconstruction of the temple, and they could physically see Herod's vision for a Jerusalem, this would buy him some leeway with the elites of Jerusalem. It also serves as a way of financing future projects. He obviously needed a lot of money to get these completed. He didn't have enough money to build everything. You would need a pretty bulletproof finance structure behind you, and you'd also need to raise taxes. So in order to raise taxes, you have to keep people in work. If people are working, everyone's happy and they have something to do, they have less time to complain about taxes. And you'd also have to get the people on side. They'd have to understand that the taxes were to build the future Jerusalem and that a lot of jobs were going to come out of it. The rebuilding of the temple is strategic and political, and also served as a way to bankroll and fast-track future building projects. Some of these projects may have been a bit more, not more ambitious, because I don't think there's anything more ambitious than the reconstruction of the Second Temple, but it served as a way to get some of his more controversial projects fast-tracked through the elites, such as the port city, Herodium, some of his more Hellenistic-styled buildings. And obviously the Second Temple didn't have a lot of Hellenistic features. It was pretty much designed for religion and worship, and he didn't really want to piss anyone off. So he made a functional temple that could serve as a place of worship, meeting, markets, much the way it had been run in the past. These building projects aren't just simply building projects, they are political tools. It does make sense that this is one of the first projects he got financed and got off the ground. So the reconstruction of the temple was a massive undertaking. First up, Herod had to raise the finances just to build the thing. Obviously, this meant raising taxes, getting financiers, selling and importing goods, all to cover the cost of the massive building constructions. So after he had acquired the financing and the funds, he had got it passed through the high priests and the elites, he was clear and authorized to rebuild the temple. He also undoubtedly would have needed the permission of the high priests just to build anything near or on the temple. And this goes doubly for a reconstruction project of this size. After all, it was a functioning temple, and this was the base of operations for the high priesthood. On another note, it served both parties. It was good for the high priesthood and the Jewish religious sects throughout the city, and it was also good for Herod. He was respecting the old ways, but he was also facilitating the new and the future by updating the past. He wasn't so much building a completely new structure as to rebuilding a past structure in a modern way, making it more future-proof. So first up, he had to expand the temple grounds, increasing the size from 7 to 14 hectares, effectively doubling the original size. The outer walls were rebuilt after all Jerusalem had been attacked and destroyed many times. The walls were doubled in thickness and in height. It was also one of the biggest building projects of the first century. Construction began around 19 BC and wasn't finished until 9 AD, with further renovations continuing for years after that. There is also some debate of the dating. Like most historical dates, some historians have the starting date around 25 BC and the start date of the temple at 19 BC. All in all, it took around 46 years to finish, and unfortunately for Herod, he wouldn't live long enough to see its completion. And it wasn't long after it had been finished that it was destroyed by the Romans once and for all. The western wall, the tunnel system, and a few other random bits and pieces are all that are left of Herod's temple today. And I think we'll leave it there for now, and we'll pick up the construction of the second temple in the next episode. So look out for part 2 of part 3, or part 2 of part 2A of part 3 of King Herod in the next couple of weeks. The next episode will be dedicated solely to the second temple. We'll be having a very in-depth and detailed look at it, from its construction, some of the more mysterious and weirder things about a certain stone, and about its legacy. The following episode, I'll hopefully tie up the epic saga of King Herod. On the following episode, so part 5, we'll be having a look at the various other construction projects of King Herod, such as Herodium, the port city, the aqueducts, Masada, and the rest of his building projects. So definitely stay tuned for that. So the next episode should hopefully be out in a couple of weeks, and then I can go into researching what will hopefully be the final part. There may or may not be a delay on release with that. I'm hoping to get more episodes out. Then after Herod has been finalized, we can go into some other areas. I've got a good conspiracy podcast planned after the epic saga of Herod. I'll give you a hint, it involves one of the most influential rock stars of his time. Well, maybe not a rock star, but one of the most influential musicians of his time. So definitely tune in for that. All right, thank you very much to everyone who listened. Once again, the next episode should be out in a couple of weeks, so look out for that. If you'd like to support the Truth Tank, there's a few things you can do to help the show grow. You can follow and like the Facebook page. I will hopefully have a Instagram and a Twitter set up for the Truth Tank sometime in the future, hopefully pretty soon. If you feel so inclined and you would like to support the podcast, hit that subscribe button on iTunes, Podbean, Google, Spotify, or wherever else you get your podcasts from. Spread the word, tell your friends, tell your family, strangers on the bus and people on the street, or anyone else you think might like the Truth Tank. Really appreciate all the downloads all around the world. All right, I'll be back soon, but until then, I'm the Tank, this is the Truth, may the Truth be with you.